So the examples of images that have been obtained primarily with surface waves is this three-dimensional view of the structure under Africa, where there are real roots. You can see there's incisor and molar. The incisor is the West African craton. The structure, this is the Moho, and this is 670 kilometers, of course, great vertical exaggeration. And some of these roots appear to be going down to great depth, but this is the larger contrast, and that sort of goes down to 250 or 300 kilometers. You can also make a cross-section. This is a polar cross-section along this yellow line. This again is Moho, and this is 670. And here you see the very slow structures and the ridges, and fast structure roots every time you cross a continent. So all this has been obtained actually using very long period surface waves. When we talk about surface waves, okay, so the surface waves are probably the largest feature on a seismogram. So this is an example of a seismogram. It's rotated, vertical, transverse, and radial component. You see here a big thing, which is called Rayleigh. These are Rayleigh waves. They represent PSV motion. You can see it both on the vertical and radial component. You see something different on a transverse component, and this is called Love waves. They're named after two English applied mathematicians, physicists, in the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century. It's the same guy. He was pretty active. Again, the same thing that I already said is that if you go from the source to the receiver, you have a motion, Rayleigh wave motion, in a vertical plane, while the Love wave motion is only perpendicular in a horizontal plane, perpendicular to the direction of propagation. The surface waves are dispersed, which means that waves with different periods travel with different speeds or different frequencies. So here, for example, you have a full transverse component, which presumably would be Love wave, and it's now filtered with a center at 14 and a half second filter, 19, 28, 51, and eventually 109. And in this particular case, the longer the period, the higher is velocity. As it turns out, what you look here, and especially if you look at the envelope of these wave groups, you are looking at the group velocity, not phase velocity, and we'll define these two a little bit later. This is another example at much longer periods, where you actually, this is Rayleigh waves now, and it turns out that here you have a higher frequency waves traveling with the higher group velocity than long period waves. That it actually turns out that there is a minimum at about 200 seconds in the group velocity, and that's how this looks like. So you cannot just tell that all the long period waves travel faster than the short period waves. So you have, now you can see that the raw data, this is point I guess that Guy was making yesterday, that you have a very high noise level, but much of it is microseism. So once you put it through a bandpass filter, you lose most of it. And here you just see the actual phases. So this, for example, is P here. Then you see the long period data. Now, the surface waves and free oscillations, of which Guy will be talking on Monday, are actually very close. So if you have a large earthquake here, this is distance. and this is time, the surface waves that are generated by this earthquake can propagate several times, many times, around the world. And there is a sort of convention of naming the Rayleigh waves are R, and the R1 is the minor arc path. This is station, so minor arc is the, in this case, 90 degrees. The major arc would be 270 propagation the other way. So then it comes here, the say distance 50 degrees. So it's R1, R2, R3, which is R1 that propagated one additional full orbit. Now, if you take this very long seismogram, I think that there is actually a stack of, it's same guy that, Peter Scheer, who does these things. This actually is an extension of that. It would go up nearly to the ceiling if you stacked it. But this is R1, this is R2, this is R3, and this is R4. So it's plotted as a distance, and you can see that the Rayleigh waves have the largest slope. This is like this travel time plot. So the smaller or the lower the slope, the faster a wave propagates. Okay, that's the slope here is 1 over v, where v in this case is group velocity. You can see that there are some waves that propagate much faster than the Rayleigh waves. And these are some very different forms of body waves that actually at long periods take also a long time to be attenuated. So if you take a spectrum of, for example, seismogram that has 10 hours duration, and all these arrivals, you are going to get a bunch of spectral peaks because of the positive interference at the time at for the wavelengths that are L plus half times the circumference of the Earth. And Guy will talk about it. The theory essentially is so the surface waves traditionally have been referred to the flat Earth. But obviously the Earth is, and there was some major computational savings when you dealt with a flat Earth as opposed to spherical Earth. But with the speed with which computers now work, it doesn't make any sense to trouble yourself going to the flat Earth and then making some corrections, but you essentially use the same theory as in normal mode theory. Other than when we talk about surface waves, we usually think about propagating waves rather than standing waves. But because Earth is spherical, the two, there's one-to-one correspondence between the two. Yeah. Let's see. Oh, I'm sorry, I guess. At 180 degrees, the world is very small at 180 degrees, so I guess probably there were relatively few seismograms that would correspond to exactly 180 degrees, at exactly the antipodes of the earthquake. Presumably 0 degrees is where the earthquake is, and it was stuck all on earthquakes. But if you think the annulus is extremely small at 180, so this is, you are missing here 2 or 3 degrees, and just simply there weren't that many stations at the antipodes. But there is no physical reason other than sort of mathematical reason that the 180 degrees is just a point on the sphere, and it's very unlikely that you are going to have a station there.
You also can define
Well, yeah, but I mean, you could have a seismogram which actually what happens is there is a focusing effect. So the amplitudes actually grow somewhat at this point, but you are missing, it gets pretty complicated at 180 degrees, but I don't think that this is the reason. It's just simply that there weren't that many stations at these distances. Many of the slides that I show come from collection of Göran Ekström, so this is one of them, sort of intuitively indicating that short period waves sample only the shallow structure, long period waves sample deep structure. So by observing things at different frequencies, we essentially can obtain sensitivity at a large range of depths. The other important thing is, opposite to body waves, is that surface waves travel well along the surface, and even they can sample regions where you have no sources and no seismic stations. Body waves go inside the Earth, but if you have big place like Pacific with very few stations, you're going to have very large gaps in coverage. But the surface waves propagate near surface whether there are stations or not. So in some sense, they actually provide a better and more even coverage than the body waves. There are two concepts in terms of velocity of propagation of the waves. What this diagram shows, you have two frequencies that are pretty close to each other, and when they are summed up, they form these beats. You have the carrier frequency, which is this high frequency, and then you have essentially the amplitude modulation, which looks like this. So one velocity with which the wave travels is the phase velocity. It's the same phase. For example, here you have the peak, which is connected by this short dashed line. And the slope of it is 1 over c. So that's a phase velocity. On the other hand, you have propagation of these wave groups and the envelope. So here they decided to connect the zero point on the envelope. And you can see that they connect with a different slope than c. And actually, this slope is steeper, which means that the u group velocity is lower than phase velocity. And what you see on a seismogram, you actually see the arriving energy. So it's a little bit confusing, but you actually, on a seismogram, when you look at it, when you put it through narrow bandpass filter, you actually observe a group energy arriving, and the phase is sort of hidden behind the Fourier transform. This is an example of a dispersion curve, where here you have a period. It's more, some people like to do things in frequency because that's essentially the things depend on frequency. Period is, in terms of the circular frequency, 2 pi over omega. But because surface waves have periods that go into tens, hundreds, or even, if you want, thousands of seconds, it's easier to use whole numbers than fractions. So the traditional unit or traditional variable is period. You can see there is a phase velocity, which becomes very flat at the top, and then there is group velocity, which is lower than the phase velocity. Essentially, the definition of the phase velocity is that c is equal to omega over k, where k, omega is circular frequency, and k is the wave number. This is phase velocity. On the other hand, u, the group velocity, is d omega by dk. So it's a derivative, as if. And it turns out that u, in general, will be lower than c if there is dependence on period. If you have non-dispersive wave, then both group and phase velocity are the same. This is sort of a medieval picture from about 1961. This is when people started looking at, well, the free oscillations. I guess maybe it's 62. Free oscillations were just observed, and people studied with great intensity. So anyway, this is the Rayleigh wave dispersion curve. As you can see, even then people realized that it connects itself to free oscillations. So the period here goes up to, well, somewhere over 1,000 seconds. Here you have this minimum that I mentioned at about 225 seconds. And then depending whether you have a continental structure, which has the thick crust, you have this long sort of fall off in group velocity. And if you have oceanic structure, it has a maximum at shorter periods, like 20 or 30 seconds. And then it nosedives because of the properties of the ocean layer. The same thing. And then there are pieces of some higher modes that have been observed. But as I say, this is sort of the beginning of the modern seismology. And this is the same thing for Love waves. Notice that there is here in group velocity, you have a very long range in which group velocity is nearly constant, which means that the waves from a wide range of frequencies arrive at the same time. And it gives rise to a very large amplitude wave, which Gutenberg first identified, and this is why it's called G wave. So this is after Benno Gutenberg. And probably if you play with seismograms enough, you will find that. Now, you can imagine medium in terms of layers. It turns out that the Rayleigh waves exist also in just a half space. You have a half space which is constant elastic parameters, and the Rayleigh waves will exist in it because you have two boundary conditions which can be satisfied, and therefore you can have a two parameters which sort of dependence of displacement on depth. So the classical calculation is that for the single layer or the half space, and you get from this solution, which will tell you that you have both vertical and horizontal motion. This is a cross section in a vertical plane. You have essentially this is direction of the propagation, but the particle motion is retrograde and elliptical. And this is the relationship between horizontal and vertical, or radial and vertical components. It seems like this is leading by half pi. However, this is a wrong plot for the classical Rayleigh wave, which is non-dispersive. Essentially, since it's just uniform half space, all waves propagate with the same velocity, but they can penetrate to different depths. This is essentially the displacement function as a function of depth, normalized here to the wavelengths. So you can see that the greater is the wavelengths, the greater would be corresponding depth. Here they are equal, and you still have fairly significant displacement at UZ, that is at the depth that corresponds to the wavelengths. Now, for Love waves, you cannot have a half space, uniform half space, because essentially in some way, the definition of surface waves is that if you represent a variable such as, for example, vertical displacement u as a function of some amplitude, which is a function of depth, times cosine omega t minus kx, perhaps some phase here, that A of z tends to 0 as z approaches infinity, so that the motion is confined to the surface and there is a certain depth at which essentially displacement goes to zero. So if you have only a uniform half space, you have one boundary condition for love waves, which is the vanishing stress, and essentially the only solution is a trivial solution, the zero displacement. However, if you have a layer over half space, then you can trap the energy in the upper layer, and it will be exponentially decaying in a lower layer. And this is the classical love wave calculation. Additional requirement is that beta 1 will be less than beta 2, because otherwise, this is the way in which you can confine the energy to the upper medium. The love waves, because of the greater complexity, in addition to the fundamental mode, which is this mode, which does not change the sign. Displacement does not change the sign. It's called fundamental mode. It penetrates at a particular period to the shallowest depths. You can see here that most 99% of energy is confined actually to the top 40 kilometers or so. And then there are higher modes, and the one that crosses zero line once is the first higher mode. This is one that crosses zero line twice, and this is called second higher mode. And you can see that it penetrates to significantly greater depths. This is at the longer period of 10 seconds. Then at the period of 30 seconds, the higher modes cannot exist anymore, and you have only fundamental mode. As you can see, it penetrates to much larger depths than these, but essentially the amplitude decays exponentially all the way. So for all of them, in this half space under the layer, you have exponentially decaying motion. So this condition that the amplitude goes to zero as z approaches infinity is satisfied. Now, the calculations of dispersion. Dispersion is relation. You can pick your variable. You can have omega as a function of k, or you can have k as a function of omega. But that essentially gives you the dispersion relationship. Okay, and omega over k is equal to phase velocity, which is another variable, but depends on the other two. You can have either stratified half space where the properties change as a continuous function of z. I guess you can have also discontinuity, or a stack of layer. You can see that if you make the layers sufficiently thin, you can approximate with arbitrary precision what happens in a continuously varying medium. The layered structure is mostly important for historical reasons, because within each layer there exists analytical solution which consists of a sum of two exponential functions, and then you have boundary conditions at each layer, but you can essentially jump through the layer by predicting the properties of the solution. And eventually, the last layer must be the one where only exponential decay takes place. Very recently, there was a 50th anniversary of one of the first applications of computers to seismological or geophysical problems. Norman Haskell made a calculation using this layered approach of a dispersion in a very complex medium, three layers over half space. This was something that was not possible to do before, but he had access, being at Air Force laboratory, he had access to a computer then, and this, as I say, was the first calculation. Of course, Our computers now are some millions times faster than they used to be, but it was mind-blowing at the 1952 that you were able to actually calculate dispersion for three layers over half space. In general, in order to obtain a solution to this problem, we solve a system of linear equations in the form that df, and that's vector, over dz is equal to some matrix, which is function of z times f of z. So this is a system of first order linear differential equations. The way you do it for Laveau waves, f has dimension of 2, for Rayleigh waves has dimension of 4. Eventually, when you go to free oscillations, you add also some gravitational perturbations, and then you go to a dimension of 6. Through proper substitutions, it is possible to bring this to this system. Usually, variables for Rayleigh waves would be vertical and horizontal displacement, and radial and tangential stress. They have to satisfy boundary conditions at the surface, the vanishing of stresses. Of course, you can make more complicated things. You can have a water of layer on a top of elastic half space. And the approach is that you start at the bottom of the last layer, just over the half space that then goes all the way down. You assume particular form of a solution. You propagate it upward to the surface, and you perturb whichever, let's say, k, such that at a particular omega, you find a k for which the boundary condition is satisfied. And that's your solution. So you essentially have a secular equation with zero crossings, and you find the zero crossing. Because there are overtones, there will be number of zero crossing, but one that corresponds to the lowest frequency is the fundamental mode, and then you have higher overtones. So for Laveau waves, it's only two equations, and the boundary condition is vanishing of the stress at the free surface, the tangential stress. It's not actually tangential, it's a horizontal stress. Well, basically, if you want exact prescription, how it's done, it's very well explained in the book Quantitative Seismology by Aki and Richards. But essentially, there's a zillion programs. And as I say, it's very seldom now, because of the ease and speed with which computers work, that we essentially have to go to flat layer system. We essentially solve things for spherical geometry. It is a little bit more time consuming, but it's not really a big problem. Now, one reason why we want to measure this is because we want to find out a structure as a function of depth. Part of your solution depends on the displacement and stress function as a function of depth, and the sensitivity of, for example, phase velocity, delta C over C, at some particular period, can be expressed as an integral from 0 to infinity, or minus infinity, because that's z is negative. And you have certain kernel functions, such as s, which is function of z, times delta vs as a function of z, divided by vs 0, starting module, plus, say, p, everything is function of z, delta vp over vp0 plus r times delta rho, where rho is density, over rho, and all this is integrated with respect to depth. So these are called differential kernels or sensitivity functions. And for example, for surface waves, for Love waves, the sensitivity is only to density and shear velocity. Shear velocity, very, very much sensitivity dominates, and it's also true for Rayleigh waves. So very often these terms are dropped and you essentially look for solution for the shear velocity. So what's shown here in this slide, now this is depth from the surface to 700 kilometers, and this is sensitivity function that the Rayleigh wave, for example, at the period of 350 seconds has. And it has a maximum just before the transition zone. Okay, so that actually, the waves, Rayleigh waves with this period will penetrate and have a maximum sensitivity in a transition zone. Okay, but if you go to shorter periods, 35 seconds is the first one, it essentially has a peak somewhere above the depth of 100 kilometers, and then decays very rapidly. So you can see that this order of magnitude in a period covers very large range of depths, and if you can measure phase velocity at all these periods, you actually can retrieve the perturbation that you need to make to some starting model, reference model such as PREM, in order to fit particular measurements of delta C over C. Is that reasonably clear? Good. Now, Love waves have very different properties. They don't have this sort of maximum sensitivity at fairly large depth. As this, I think it's 200 second wave has. They essentially have all highest sensitivity near the surface, maybe at the top of the MOHO, and after that decay fairly rapidly. So you can see that 350 second Love wave has some sensitivity to the structure in the transition zone, but it's several times less than the shallow structure. Both, if you use both of them, assuming that you don't deal with an anisotropic medium, you actually improve greatly your resolution, because these two sets of kernel functions have these very different properties. However, if you have transverse isotropy or radio anisotropy, then you essentially can get more or less SH from this. This will be mostly sensitive to the SH velocity. This will be mostly sensitive to SV velocity. Yeah, they sort of seem that this increases. I don't know, but at the discontinuity, you essentially, displacements of course are continuous, stresses are continuous, but the strains are not. Okay, so this expresses in some way effect of the discontinuity in strain at the boundary. Yeah, it sort of seems like they have opposite sensitivity here, that it drops in case of Rayleigh waves and seems to increase a little bit in terms of Love waves. And it's one of these details that, thank you for noticing it. Okay, now we are talking about measuring phase velocity. How do we do this? The main thing is like what Guy had said, that people in the past did it sort of one trace by another, and they would essentially take a wave train, Fourier transform it, and then try to find a phase. The phase, which is this, I mean, we, in general, your seismogram can be represented in a frequency domain by the amplitude spectrum times a phase spectrum, and the phi of omega is something that will actually control the phase velocity. A is important if you want to measure attenuation, but of course there are all kinds of problems with focusing, defocusing, and I will not talk about this. The phase spectrum depends on the source mechanism, which is this phi s, which can be calculated if you know what was the source mechanism, whether it was a strike slip, dip slip, any combination of the two. The phi p is the propagation term and is determined by integration of omega divided by phase velocity and integrated along the ray path. Like in body wave seismology, we essentially assume that, although it's not totally necessary, but for most parts the Fermat principle works. So even though on a heterogeneous Earth the ray path may not follow the great circle, but we assume that the prediction of the reference model are correct. So if you have a reference model such as PREM, you can actually calculate this phase for the reference model. And then basically the phase that you observe will be a sum of the phase predicted by the reference model plus some perturbation in phi. Okay, and all this is equal to omega times distance divided by C0, which is reference phase velocity, plus some perturbation in the phase velocity. Now, the problem with phase is that it has a 2 pi cyclicity. So, if you have very large phase, it's very easy to miss a circle or two, and you'll get the same result, in which case, of course, you have get wrong phase velocity. So the trick is to get started on the right track. And this is basically, it's a pretty picture. It also shows that we have all the earthquakes that would be of interest for which we would like to measure phase velocities, we actually have a source mechanism. So we can correct or calculate the source phase relatively easy. This is a CMT project at Harvard, which now we have solutions for over 20,000 earthquakes. And if you need to know the mechanism, all you have to do is to go to our website. It's not advertisement, it's good advice. So, Joran figured out a strategy for dealing with this problem by having noticed that, now this is in frequency as opposed to period, that at the longest periods or lowest frequencies, that for one thing the variability in phase is less. So that actually the starting model usually will get you within the right circle between 0 and 2 pi. And you can bootstrap by starting here at the very long period and then adding additional frequencies and essentially requiring that the perturbation in phase velocity would be a smooth function. How does it work? Well, this is how it works in principle. This is your whole observed seismogram. The one at the bottom is predicted by PREM. And you can see that they look extremely different. However, if you pass it at some, let's say, from 100 to 250 seconds, that part is quite similar. They're only offset by about pi by 2. Particularly if you look at the longest period, they actually look extremely similar. So you can get started here. And then you go to a higher frequency, which is shown here, and you can obtain a good match at this frequency, and then you go to still higher frequency, and eventually you can reproduce or model the seismogram pretty much exactly. So I guess I have some more stuff which shows it in number of... So you start at the longest period, And here you have your, and you model it. And here you can see that for these top three traces, observed and modeled phase are the same. So this corresponds to the agreement between these two seismograms. And the difference is very small. And if you blow it up, you can see that actually you don't have much of a residual anywhere where you have a big signal. And then you can calculate the correlation, which autocorrelation in particular is something that, well, it's a symmetric function, but in addition, it will tend to gather all the signal at the same time. And basically, if your calculation of dispersion for this particular seismogram is right, your cross-correlation between observed signal and modeled signal should also be a symmetric function. As you can see here, it pretty much is at the point where it matters, that's at zero lag time. Now, however, this is just for the longest periods. You can see that here you still have differences at higher frequencies. So now we are expanding the window, and now we go from 41 to 250 seconds. You get more complex seismogram. You also get very good fit and essentially no residual. But you still see that at the highest frequencies here, you still have a mismatch in phase. Okay, so you go to the third step, and at that point you have the entire seismogram with the highest frequencies, and again everything matches very well, and as a result you have a function. You actually can store the amplitude as well as the phase, and you have performed measurement for this particular path. And things got so that by and large it can be done automatically and doesn't really require anybody looking at these things. So it can be, and as a result, there's probably something of the order of 100,000 or more paths for which both Rayleigh and Love waves have been measured. So it's a very large data set, and you can do all kinds of things with it. This is actually to show you, these are Love waves at 35 second period. This is just about as far as you can go. There's a big cloud of points, and what they actually represent, this is observed perturbation phase versus that predicted by the model, and we'll talk about modeling a little bit later. But the idea is that basically you predict very well, and you essentially are on this slope one curve. There are some outliers, and some of them may represent very anomalous paths, and some of them may essentially represent mistakes. This is in radians, I guess, the scale. Notice that it goes, essentially measurements go from plus to minus 30 radians. Now if we do the same thing make a similar plot for Rayleigh waves at 150 second period, notice that the variability is only about plus or minus 2 radians. Okay, so for one thing you have, that's phase. So plus minus 2 radians corresponds to about 50 seconds in time. But there are two things. So even in terms of full circles, you have much less variability than for the love wave. It's partly because of this that the signal noise ratio is not as good, because there is much less signal. Probably noise is also less, but there's much less signal. And here you actually see that perhaps, just by eye, there's a little bit differential slope between the diagonal and what actually the so it looks like as perhaps the model might have been a little bit dumped more, and therefore the predictions are on a slightly lower slope than one. But it's a very marginal thing, and Now, so the phase anomaly can be written as an integral over great circle from source to receiver with respect to element of the length, relative perturbation frequency, which is function of theta and phi. In this case, we can do it in some other parameterization, but essentially we are expanding delta C over C in spherical harmonics. So you have some unknown coefficients, and then you have a spherical harmonics YLM. And we also define the RMS gradient. That's a roughness. And we essentially want to satisfy that we want to find a model that will minimize chi square over n plus some coefficient which is empirically determined and the function of roughness. And so gamma is this damping parameter and it's usually established empirically. To give you an example how it works, so for example the lower diagram is a spherical harmonic expansion just plotted for mostly Eurasia. Love waves, so this is observed or obtained from the inversion for local phase velocity. Okay, and you can see that extremely slow velocities here under Tibet. The diagram above is a prediction what would happen to love waves if you only took into account the crust, which in this particular case is a paper by Mooney and others, where they have expanded, where they have essentially 5 by 5 degree blocks with defined crustal structure. So actually, about 90% of energy can be just predicted by the crustal structure. So, however, you can see that you don't quite predict the observed very low velocity under Tibet, and part of it might have had something to do with the Mooney's model in Tibet. Yeah.
Does it make any sense to actually combine multiple log wave periods, or is this actually seeing a particular depth?
No, this is essentially this is observed. It's a result of the inversion that I described on the previous slide. It's essentially solving for these spherical harmonic coefficients, and then once you have those, then you can predict or plot the map at any particular frequency. Here we do that in a lower diagram. Let's see. So this is, it's called observed, but it's basically obtained from inversion. Okay. Here you have just a simple prediction, forward problem, where you have no crustal structure and you calculate how much, and the model is homogeneous below it, how much perturbation to the love wave will come from the crustal structure. And basically the point I'm trying to make here is that you can predict quite a lot just on the basis of the crust. That the 35 seconds, the characteristics of the lateral variations in love waves are determined mostly by the crustal structure, not entirely. And one way to check this is to use a different type of decomposition. This has been done since some time in the mid-60s, about 30 years now, or 40 years, actually, where there's so-called pure path phase velocities. The assumption is that different geological regions have a structure that essentially is the same as a function of depth, so that if you have a craton, all the cratons look the same as a function of depth, that young oceans look the same as a function of depth, and so forth. There's particular regionalization that's sort of well known and published by Jordan, 1978 or something, and it's called GTR, I guess, GTR1, Jordan 1981. And basically what you do is you have some unknown coefficients you know where the different regions are, and you essentially try to represent the phase as a sum of the effect of all the regions through which particular great circle path traveled. And you can obtain this misfit function and see how well you can do with by using just six regions. So this is an example where here we invert for spherical harmonics. These are the love waves. This is a period. So you can, if you fit spherical harmonics, you can get about 97% variance reduction using very little difference between maximum order being 16 or 40. 16 is about 300 coefficients, 40 is 16 or 1700. So you get very little improvement in the fit by essentially quintupling the number of unknown coefficients. So there could be, obviously, some of those will be poorly determined. I think that error analysis that indicates that you don't quite get enough variance reduction by going to degree 16, but you should be aware of it. That now, what happens with the regionalization? It works reasonably good. You remove about 90 or 87% of the variance simply by using the six-region regionalization. So instead of 300 unknowns, you have only six. But then as the period increases, this fit gets worse and worse. And the reason is, this is why you need tomography, because you cannot predict properties deep inside the Earth just on the basis of what you know at the surface. Similar picture exists for radio waves. At the short periods, reduction is not quite as good. It's somewhat also not as good, but here at 150 seconds, regionalization removes only about 30% of the variance, while you remove about 70% of the variance by fitting spherical harmonics. So this is illustration. I showed this figure when I try to convince people that they really need tomography. There's been an attempt in France to do things without seismology by just using the sort of geodynamic predictions. And this essentially illustrates that it doesn't quite work. You actually will remove some variance because it's rather similar to this GTR1 model, perhaps even finer parametrization. But it does not predict differences in what would appear to be the same setting, but there are actually differences in depth. We see very clearly differences, for example, in the ocean basins. This is a path that's more or less parallel and travels for a period of time right on the ridge, East Pacific Rise. Here is the path that goes across the Nazca Plate to Arequipa, and it obviously involves ocean of higher age, and you can see very distinct difference in velocities between the path from whatever this earthquake is to Tucson and paths to Arequipa. And Tucson is much slower because it's close to the ridge axis. So people have figured out that you are going to have some dependence of phase velocities on ocean age. They also, so this is, for example, a set of measurements of phase velocities. This is by Forza and Nishimura. The phase velocity is a function of age. This is very close. This is mostly from the Pacific, I guess only from the Pacific. So there's 0 to 4 million years, very young ocean floor, very slow. And then as you go up in age, it gets faster and faster. And this is a result of inversion. And except for the very old oceans, basically the differences appear to tend to disappear at the depth of about 140 or 150 kilometers. So there are very large differences, very pronounced low velocity zone at a depth of about 50 kilometers, then the low velocity zone, the maximum travels, migrates deeper, but also it's much shallower. So it has to do with the cooling of the oceanic lithosphere. However, it turns out that things are not that simple. We talked already about the radioanisotropy. In order to reduce number of independent variables, we assume that the p velocities are correlated or proportional, perturbations are proportional to the s velocities, both sh and sv. And then one of the fifth parameter, which is the ratio between f and 2a minus l, or a minus 2l, is equal to 1. That reduces the thing only to two variables out of total of 5. Now, this is how this radioanisotropy works. This is actually PREM at the depth of MOHO depth, 100 kilometers, 200 kilometers. This is VP. As you can see, it has maximum the VPH. This is measured as a function of incidence angle, so the zero angle is vertical. This is horizontal, so the VPH velocity is higher than VPV. Here you have both VSV and VSH, and VSH is dashed line. Again, VSH is higher than VSV, and VSV in particular has this 4 theta dependence. So this is something that we'll also see when the axis is, this is vertical axis. But in terms of shear at the ocean, at the bottom of the oceanic lithosphere, actually there will be tendency to elongate axis horizontally. So this is actually shown here. We'll show it twice. If you have no order, the axis, or this would be the axis of symmetry, is oriented randomly. This is map view from the top. This is a cross section. Okay, if you have a horizontal plane, is the, so they have, we have a radio anisotropy. In this case, you have a random orientation of fast axis in a horizontal plane, but a preferred orientation in the cross section. So they will all, for example, here tend to be horizontal. If you now have the horizontal direction preferred, they're actually organized both in a map view and in a cross section. So as you can see, these two cases are quite different in the sense of higher level of ordering for the what would be called azimuthal anisotropy, because in this case, the velocity will change as a function of the azimuth near the surface. Here, the velocity will change, as the function of the orientation. So here you detect difference between SV and SH. Here you detect difference as a function of the angle. And you can have both 2 phi, there's always 180 degree symmetry, but actually you have also 4 phi anisotropy. Very strong anisotropy here in a relatively young Pacific. It actually tends to be fairly perpendicular to the East Pacific rise. But by the time you get to about 100 million years of age, just beyond Hawaii, the anisotropy seems to die down. So in this particular inversion, we inverted, or Joran did, I didn't actually have anything to do with it. We at Harvard, I guess. Five times as many parameters. One for isotropic variations, which are shown here in this color, and then two for the 2 phi terms and two for 4 phi terms. And the 4 phi terms are shown here as the crosses, because there are two fast axes at 90 degrees to each other. This is just 2 phi term expanded for the Pacific, and you can see this very strong orientation also here, that the fast axis is perpendicular to the spreading ridge, but then at the center of the Pacific things die down. And why would that be? You can also show that, do it at different periods, and you get coherent picture even though these are independent sets of data. So it seems like it's real, and it actually can be observed at periods as long as 150 seconds, even though here you have less emphasis on a very fast structure right on the East Pacific rise. But at 100 second period, you still have very strong anisotropy in the same direction. So it's, I'm not sure that, it's obviously something that still needs to be worked on, is to actually obtain this anisotropy as a function of depth. The other type of anisotropy that's observed is, we'll talk about the anisotropy in the horizontal direction. And here, the was studied by, again, Forsa and Nishimura. This is reproduction of the picture from the same paper. This is the SH velocity as a function of the age of the oceanic lithosphere, or Pacific lithosphere in particular. And this is the ratio of the horizontal velocity to the vertical velocity, so-called xi. And this is the xi parameter is plotted here. So for example, here it indicates that the horizontal velocity is about 3% faster in this range. But notice one thing, which essentially Forsythe in, or Nishimura and Forsythe have missed, that the differences between the SH velocities at large depths go to a larger depth than for the Rayleigh waves. See here, except for this line, they end at about 125 or so kilometers. Here they go all the way down to 300 kilometers, or certainly to 200 kilometers, they are still fairly pronounced. And so it seems that if you really carefully look, they essentially tended to disregard. Love waves are always a little bit more difficult to observe, and they disregarded to some extent the implication of this result. They attached more weight, but what really happens is that if you solve separately for SV and SH, you get a fairly coherent map. And the main difference is in the Pacific Ocean, where at the depth of 150 kilometers for SH, you still have velocities that are very much correlated to or tied to the mid-ocean ridge structure, while for Rayleigh waves, or rather SV, you essentially, velocities are flat from the ridge all the way to Hawaii. And that basically indicates anisotropy, and it's particularly strong in the Pacific. You don't see it in the other ocean basins, although I guess there may be, there's some inference, I think, around here in the Indian Ocean. But they actually, SV and SH, there are some different opinions on this, but I guess this very strong difference at 150 kilometers, this is pretty deep, is a, well, relatively new thing. This is now the SV, SH, and their difference plotted at three different depths. So this is 50 kilometers, this is 100, this is 150. When people plotted their models at 100 kilometers, because it's a nice round number, you actually don't have much of anisotropy at 100 kilometers. But if you plot it at either 50 or 150, you actually get quite a bit of it. And actually, it's interesting that this is with respect to PREM, that here, in relative sense, SV is higher than PREM SH. But here is the opposite thing. And not much anywhere else. Yeah. Well, yes, but we went to 252nd period, and at that point they still have very good resolution at that depth. If we tried to do it for a transition zone, I would be suspicious myself. But at 150 kilometers is still okay, even maybe at 200. So we plot one parameter, which is the isotropic variations, and that's a void average, where you take an average with a two-thirds weight for SV and one-third weight for SH. That's essentially average, and plot it as isotropic variation. Here is the SV minus SH, and you can see this is very nicely confined to the mid-ocean ridge, with the exception of what's the swell, super swell in the Pacific, which seems to be a thermostructure that's sort of... On the other hand, here you have a maximum, which is not really that much less in amplitude than right variations at the mid-ocean ridge, which are centered a little bit southwest of the Hawaii. So for whatever reason, you have this very large anisotropy in the middle of the Pacific. Now, this is a cross-section which indicates that for the isotropic variations, you have exactly what you would expect. You have very low velocities on the East Pacific rise. Essentially, the velocities, because of the cooling of lithosphere, increase. All these layers are dipping and becoming fast. And then eventually, you have the subduction zone with this widening, where we think that the slabs are piling up, and pretty much the same thing on the under South America. However, there is this radioanisotropy, and there seems to be sort of qualitative similarity to the volume of the volcanics in the Pacific. And the indication would be that perhaps through some reheating process, we have on one hand erased the horizontal anisotropy, because remember, this is a region where there is no azimuthal anisotropy, and introduced by injecting new material, we have introduced a different type of anisotropy, where if the material spread horizontally at a depth of about 150 kilometers. So that's essentially what I wanted to say about the surface waves and their applications to studies of the Earth. And you'll get much more theoretical account, I think, from Guy about the normal modes. And just remember that much of the normal mode theory is applicable to surface waves as long as you connect the traveling wave with the standing wave image. Thank you. By the way, there's a very nice review paper which eventually will be posted on the web, written by Barbara, about the inversion of seismic waves. There will be also a PDF file with Ekstrom et al. Article already is. It exists on the computer, but not on the web yet. And remember that if you want to get into nitty-gritty of calculation of dispersion and eigenfunctions and all this, that you should go to quantitative seismology by Aki and Richards, which actually there's a new edition published now, so it's been out of print for a long time. Yeah.
One is, so when people talk about doing 2D and 3D models, are they first starting with, I'm trying to clarify that that's, if I'm understanding it right. They will first start with GREM, which is the same symmetric GREM, which is spherical symmetry.
Yeah.
And then they use this 2D and 3D models as perturbations over period.
Yes. Right? Yes, because generally the seismic problems, this is true also in case of body waves. They are nonlinear. That is, the functionals of the model are not a linear function of the model parameters. So whenever this happens, I mean, one of the geophysical inverse problem is that due to gravity. So that actually is proportional to the density distributions. So it's an example of a linear problem which we can solve linearly, other than we cannot because it's non-unique. In non-linear problems, we have to have a starting model. And the requirement is, which you really don't know at first, is that this starting model be linearly close to the real Earth. And I think that we are within that regime. If it weren't true, then you have to use one of these variations of the Monte Carlo technique, where you essentially assume or build in a random fashion some model, predict functionals for it, and then see whether they satisfy your data. But I mean, it's possible to combine two effects, is to see whether, explore the linearity, that is, you, for example, start with different starting models and see whether they tend to converge to the same final model. Does this answer your question?
Yeah. The other question was, I do realize that with surface waves, you cannot see, if you were to do tomography, you can't see probably beyond like 700 kilometers or something like that.
Yes, I mean, you know, the surface waves and normal modes merge. And one particular thing about normal modes, and Miyake has done quite a bit of research on this subject, is that the what we see in terms of phase velocities, these phase velocity maps, there are ways in which the normal modes are split, a little bit like a Zeeman spectrum in spectroscopy. In presence of magnetic field, they are split, and then their splitting is a function of the structure, and it's possible, particularly for the even part of the structure, is to retrieve it. And so in a sense you can go beyond, actually some people, including Miyake, went all the way to, into the inner core with mode splitting.
In that sense, would you then be able to compare like surface wave tomography with body wave tomography to actually look at the subduction zone pooling versus penetrating problem?
Yeah. I mean, in some sense, you know, the normal mode theory is a very general theory. So you can also build body waves by summing up the modes. So in a sense, when we, and Barbara actually has more theoretically satisfying way of doing it, But in a sense, you know, you can combine travel time data with surface wave data and normal mode data. And essentially this is what good inversions contain. And as far as we can tell, all these types of data are quite compatible, and you don't have to worry too much about, for example, frequency dependence, maybe a little bit.
Okay.